This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Rees for Greg Shanley. It has a 19th century feel, but publisher Tim Fay says it's not about a trip down memory lane. Instead, the Wapsipinicon Almanac stands on its own. Modern content with a warm, neighborly feel, still printed on a 75-year-old letterpress with the letters formed out of molten lead set by a linotype machine. There's no Microsoft publisher in the Anamosa, Iowa shop. Issue 16 of the Almanac is out, complete with a talk of the township, the Four Seasons mini almanac, essays, stories, book reviews, and lots more. Coming up, we'll talk to Tim Fay about the new issue and contributors Will Thompson and Joe Arts. And later, agriculture news with Doug Cooper. First news from Iowa Public Radio and National Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Rees for Greg Shanley. The new Wapsipinicon Almanac is out, now in its 22nd year, published on a behemoth of a 1930s press. Publisher Tim Fay wouldn't have it any other way. Part of what you're trying to do is preserve the letterpress, the old-fashioned, you know, lead type, rather than going to a computer. And, I mean, that is part of what you're about, right?
I guess you could say that. I'm the printer, so that's
what...
I do all the printing and a lot of the typesetting, but I also have a typesetter who comes in and helps me, an 84-year-old gentleman named Eldon Meeks.
Now, you talk about him. He's something else, right? I mean,
he's really something else. He's one of the finest human beings I've ever met, and he's quite adept at setting type, and he's also good at keeping this crazy machine running.
Well, I mean, when you pick up the almanac, it just has a 19th century feel about it. You have the beautiful colored woodcut engraving on the cover. It's newsprint, but it's you can almost feel the ink, you know, as compared to you know, a computer offset sort of printing. And so, how long does it take him to get all of this typeset?
Well, we start setting type in probably April, and then set all through the spring and summer and into the fall. And I usually like to be done with all the typesetting by, mid-September. And, of course, I'm putting pages together all the time, proofing things, setting ads, bothering people for their essays, selling ads, and actually start the printing probably about November 1st.
Yeah. Now, what year did you start?
1988.
Yeah. Issue 16, Wapsipinicon Almanac. So is this how old is this machine that is your press?
Well,
you call it a linotype,
right? The linotype is a typesetting machine. It's vintage 1936, I'm told, and it's what's called a Model 8 linotype, and it's holding together very well. And I have a number of presses. The press that I actually print the almanac on, the text of the almanac, is from the 1950s. It's a Miller flatbed letterpress. And I print the cover on a Mealy vertical, which is probably about 1936 or so also. So we're big into the 30s there at the Route 3 Press.
So how do you find parts?
Actually, there's quite a network of letterpress printers still around. Not all of us have been buried. And there are machines and parts around. They're just a matter of finding somebody who can actually work on them. I've been so fortunate because Eldon can pretty much fix anything on the linotype.
What did he do this all his life? I mean, was he working on a newspaper in his...
Correct. Eldon is a deaf-mute man, and he was trained for this profession at the deaf school at Council Bluffs. And he worked all his life at the Anamosa newspaper until the technology changed. Then he went to work for Lawrence Press in Cedar Rapids and has been working for me part-time. A long time, since I guess about 1979.
Wow. And I have to ask, you still use lead? Is it actual lead?
Oh, it's lead, all right.
And this is not posing a health challenge to the staff? It's not.
Well, we're two old guys and we're still around, so I don't know how much of a health risk it is. I make a point not to take big draughts of lead fume. But I try to ventilate well and wash my hands frequently and all that.
I wanted to ask you about how has the content changed? I mean, it's short stories, it's essays, it's some great local ads from some some interesting businesses in the state. It's the Almanac portion is, you know, cultural news and little newsy items. Has this changed over the years?
Not particularly. The format is pretty much the same. I open the magazine with what I call the talk of the township blurbs. I didn't used to do that. I started doing that probably about the fourth issue. I used to just write an essay to open each issue, but that's probably the only format thing that's really changed.
The talk of the township, this is the township in that you live in Jones County.
Correct. Rural Anamosa.
Yeah. And you start by a very interesting essay about preserving a local cemetery that was in a state of incredible disrepair, I guess you could say, and some citizens banded together to get this little cemetery spruced up and looking great. Can you describe a little bit about that?
Well, I don't know if what I wrote does the view from that place justice. You walk up this hill, and you can just see for miles and miles, and it's just such a beautiful variation of landscape. It's rolling wooded hills in the Buffalo Creek Valley and all kinds of farm fields, and it's just beautiful. You can see for miles. I think it would be an honor to be buried there. And these people have done a wonderful job of restoring that place, fixing the stones and burning the weeds and all that and planting flowers. And just a small little thing, but it's noteworthy, I think.
And you write that these people were some of the founders of, was it the town of Anamosa, or was it just some of the—
Just the rural area.
The rural area.
Area out there, yeah.
Yeah.
Pioneer family.
Yeah. Well, that's quite an accomplishment to see something like this done. And how many people are buried there?
About 20.
Will Thompson is also here. Will, welcome. You have an essay. Tell us about yourself just briefly before I ask you about the essay.
Well, I'm a longtime Iowa City resident whose former experience included a stint with the University of Iowa in the Museum of Natural History as a noted local exhibit. I'm now an exhibit designer for museums all over the state. I do exhibit design and fabrication. I do illustration work and graphic arts. In fact, I've done a few of the covers for the Almanac over the years. And
would you please tell us where you're really from?
We want to know that.
Yeah, y'all want to know. The accent isn't local. I come from North Carolina. I moved here in 82, I think it was.
Wow.
The last time we had a cold snap of this magnitude, I was just pulling into town. I grew up on the coast of North Carolina and in Raleigh, in that area. That's where I'm from, but I've lived here half my life now.
Almost a native Iowan.
Yeah.
Your story is called Self-Portrait with English Tin.
Yeah.
I'll have you describe what you mean by English Tin.
Well, there are a few of us around here who've had long-time relationships with British roadsters, with British sports cars, and I just, in searching for a title, came up with the idea of calling it English Tin because we have a sort of an odd and I think quite charmed relationship with these little cars. Most of the manufacturers of British sports cars are extinct now. The marks have either been allowed to succumb or have been bought up by foreign companies. But there are a few of us around town and the region who are pretty devoted to these little cars, and I wanted to write a sort of humorous essay about the love of these little cars.
It all started when you were a kid, and this, mm-hmm. of course, yeah. was in North Carolina.
Right.
Not here. But you passed by Mrs. Brown's house. She was an elderly woman who just happened to have a Jaguar XK120
right.
Sitting around. Why did she have this car sitting around? Was it her husband's?
It had belonged to her late son, and that's basically what I walked home from school every day, you know, and I'd like to say it was 10 miles in the snow, but it really was about 5 miles. But we had a shortcut we used to take through a wood lot, and she had this thing sitting under a tarp out in the front yard. And I just one time got the nerve to walk up and knock on the door and find out about it. That's where the story begins, really, because I was 16 years old at the time. And so I didn't have – in those days, unless you had a pretty good job on the side, you didn't have access to your own money, you know, and you couldn't get a driver's license till you were 16. And so I had to start the story here because it was where I first fell in love with these little machines. The Jaguar XK120 is a legendary piece of British sports car.
Yeah.
The 120 referred to its alleged top speed. It had a 220 horsepower side draft carbureted engine. So it was probably it looked like, well, as I wrote in the essay, it looked like it came from another planet compared to the kind of sedans that we saw around town in those
days.
Well,
the point is you wanted this car.
I wanted it,
yeah.
Yes.
And you find out the price is $600 and your dad says,
yeah.
you don't have $600.
Yeah, dad who's 92 this year and still living on the Outer Banks in North Carolina. He was a major in the Marine Corps and served overseas. So he had a very practical streak in him.
We're just about out of time for this segment. Why don't you read a little bit?
You want me to read that section?
Yeah.
Well, I'd never actually seen a Jaguar except in magazines. It was a low-slung, muscular, and sleek machine. Compared to the sedans that toured our suburban streets, it seemed exotic to the point of otherworldly. It was all hood, with a tiny cockpit and no windshield at all. The dash was mahogany and covered with toggle switches, and the two leather seats filled the rest of the cockpit. When I lifted the hood, I saw the longest engine I'd ever seen in a car. This machine really was just an engine with a seat strapped on it. It seemed built for one thing, to go fast. I was fascinated and in love. It was a Jaguar XK120 with dual overhead cam 3442cc inline six-cylinder twin side-draft carbureted 220-horsepower masterpiece of an engine that could turn 0 to 60 in 9 seconds. It sure didn't look like my cousin's 54 Ford mainliner with the Hurst shifter baby moon hubcaps, dice hanging from the rearview mirror, and a chrome gas pedal shaped like a foot. Ms. Brown was patient, although she couldn't answer most of the questions I shot at her as I gawked and drooled over this heavenly sports car. She did mention a price at which she was willing to sell. When my father got home that day, I breathlessly explained that Ms. Brown had this British roadster she would sell me for $600. The retired Marine Corps major looked at me over his can of Black Label and says, "Boy, you got three problems. You don't have $600, you don't have a driver's license, and you don't know anything about British cars. Life is tough."
Will Thompson reading from A Self-Portrait with English Tin. Gentlemen, we need to take a short break. Talking to Tim Fay, Will Thompson, Joe Arts. We'll get to you, Joe, after the break. And it's about Issue 16, the Wapsipinicon Almanac, just out, published in Anamosa, Iowa. Talk of Iowa continues in a minute. Welcome back to Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese filling in today for Greg Shanley. The topic today is the Wapsipinicon Almanac, a letterpress, wonderful letterpress almanac that's been published now for 16 years out of Anamosa, Iowa. Tim Fay is the publisher. We have two of the contributors to Issue 16, Will Thompson and Joe Arts are here. I want to get to you, Joe. You work for the Office of the State Archaeologist. I happen to know this because we share a building. You share a building with Iowa Public Radio, so we run into you all the time. How did you become a contributor to the Almanac?
That's kind of interesting because Tim originally called me asking if I would review a book about Native Americans, which I assume was Lance Foster's recently published Indians of Iowa. And so Tim said, "Well, you know, years ago, someone showed me a story that you'd written. Do you have any others?" So I sent him this story, and he said, "That looks okay. We'll put it in the almanac." So this is actually my first published fiction.
It is?
Yes.
And how long did you have this sitting around?
Oh, I think I first wrote it probably in 1994, 95. And then I took a workshop through the Center for Aging, of all things. I'm not that old, but I took the workshop through them anyway. got to workshop this piece and got to liking it. Yeah. So yeah,
and it's called God in the Rafters. Maybe describe it briefly for us.
It follows the life and ups and downs of the life of a woman who starts out as a musician, ends up as a ceramicist living in a small house with a very with a drug addict for a boyfriend, essentially. Follows the ups and downs of her life and how she loses and then refines her art.
Mm-hmm. And why don't you find a few paragraphs to share with us, if you would.
I can read a section that's a dream that the woman Elsa has as she's starting to come back to life. That night, Elsa dreamed Appalachian spring. She wore an evening gown, sitting at a piano in a pine forest. Her fingers played the keys, but she heard an orchestra's music. Her hands shaped the music with no conscious effort. As easily as a hawk gliding, the music came from her, and then to the part she liked best, the simple melody of the Shaker hymn, heard first from a clarinet, then joined by oboes and strings. She lifted her eyes from the keys. Above her, sunlight slanted through the pines. There, relaxing on a long branch, his back to the trunk, was God, a tall, thin figure in denim, with long dark hair hanging to his shoulders. He tapped his foot to the melody, and as the theme gathered strength, sprang to his feet. He danced down from the branches and out across a meadow, and Elsa followed, laughing. He went nimbly, joyously, gracefully, in great stretching bounds among flowers, over brooks, and she couldn't keep up. When he was gone, dancing away into the distance, she stood alone, feeling delighted and free. Hearing the new music, she turned and saw that the sounds like wind and the strings of a harp came from the piano in the glade. Shafts of sunlight played about the piano, twisting and turning slowly, playing this way and that over the dark varnished wood, and then the sunlight turned to flame. She sank to her knees in the grass of the meadow as the piano began to burn. The fire spread swiftly until flame rose in columns and sheets from the instrument's every surface. The piano was not consumed, but instead grew upward into the flames toward the branches of the pines overhead. At last, there was no longer a piano, but a single raging column of flame that grew so impossibly bright it was no longer fire, but light, pure, sweet light that sang with voices in indescribable beauty.
Joe Art's reading from God in the Rafters. A good feeling to be published, Joe?
Oh, yeah, it's great and completely unexpected.
Yeah.
Thanks to Tim.
Tim Fay, Wapsipinic and Almanac, issue number 16. Tim, I love the little newsy cultural bits at the beginning. Cultural news. Now, you don't write these items. They're written by one Marge Hummel. Who is Marge?
Marge is a wonderful woman who lives at Anamosa. She's retired now, and although she's been working for me since the first issue in 1988, and she worked years ago in the 60s at the Des Moines Register, and she and her husband came to Anamosa years ago, and she worked at the high school, and I printed for the high school over the years and got to know Marge and figured out that she had been a proofreader and enlisted her services, and been so glad I did.
Well, you know, a proofreader's hard person to find anymore, right? I mean,
right.
Somebody who doesn't.
A good one, anyway.
Yeah. I love her little. These are all about, you know, one short paragraph apiece. For example, on page 21, she writes, Iowans love their birds. The higher income and education level, the more likely a person is to be a bird watcher, according to a report by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Nationwide, 1 in 5 Americans, many of them Iowans, watch birds. Residents here rank 5th among the states. 88% of all participants watch from their own backyards. She doesn't make any of this up.
Oh, right? No.
These are all
see,
bird facts.
She researches all this.
Yeah. Going back to 1988, I mean, you were – did you base any of this on the Old Farmer's Almanac? Because I know they're two very different sorts of publications.
Not really, Dennis. I – liked the ring of the word almanac with Wapsipinicon. So,
and the Wapsipinicon, of course, is the river that runs through northeast Iowa, one of the rivers.
Correct. Yeah,
and a wonderful, windy, beautiful river it is.
Right? Oh, yeah.
But I'm assuming that back in the 19th century, there were more almanacs around in various parts of the country than there are today.
They were everywhere. I think a lot of patent medicine places put out almanacs or places that sold herbs and things. They would publish almanacs that had astrological things and planetary things and weather predictions and all that. Of course, there's the old Farmer's Almanac, which is still a huge success. Well, I want to clear, though, that I don't intend this to be a nostalgia piece.
Okay.
Because some people look at the letterpress format and maybe expect that, and it's not really a tract about the good old days, because I think we all know as adults that maybe the good old days weren't so great. So I just maybe throw that point out there.
Mm-hmm. And you're not preserving the letterpress for nostalgic reasons, then. You're preserving it because—
No, that's the only way I know how to print.
Really? You couldn't get a computer and learn how
to do it? I'd be all thumbs. You'd have to get Will to do that.
Tim, with the changes in the last year or two with the economy, the economic problems, and news or magazines and newspapers suffering. I mean, your almanac, your Wapsipinicon almanac, doesn't really fit into a particular category. It seems to be just its own object. And I hope you're doing well, and I hope people are still interested in buying an actual printed almanac. Because you don't have a website, right?
Yes, I do. I do have a website.
Well, can you read it online or?
No, you can't read it online. You can sure go to the website and look at a picture of me from 20 years ago. That's just wapsiealmanac.com.
Okay.
But things seem to be going well. I think that now as more people spend their whole working day in front of a computer, they don't mind holding something in their hands that they can just pick up and read.
Yeah.
So things seem to be going well.
Will Thompson, more essays to come in the future?
Well, maybe essays, maybe more graphic design work or another cover or something.
Will's done several covers for me that were all just top-notch.
Thanks. We have the thing that I wanted to say about the almanac is that it represents to me an important contribution to regionalist culture, if you want. It is a solid artifact that you can hold in your hand, and to someone who's a part-time book artist, it's a real important little plus for the almanac. But there is a tactile sense to it that, even though Tim doesn't want it to seem like an artifact of a bygone age, the thing that's current about it is the physical tactile sense of holding an intellectual artifact in your lap. And I think that's a real important part of it. What our minds do today is important. It's not about, taking trips back into the past and talking about flower-trimmed hedges and so forth. It's about the current state of awareness, I guess, if that makes any sense at all.
Yeah. Okay. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much. Will Thompson and Joe Arts, who are contributors and the editor and publisher, Wapsipinicon Almanac, Tim Fay. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Dennis.
Almanac is for sale at leading bookstores.
Leading bookstores, indeed.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Dennis.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Talk of Iowa continues. I'm Dennis Reese for Greg Shanley. Stay with us coming up next after the Environment Report, Agriculture News with Doug Cooper.
A history lesson, if you will. This week on this program, we're going to look at the history of market news and radio at Iowa State University. Goes back a long time. Goes back to when WOI was 9YI. Morse code was a means of communicating and relaying information via amateur radio operators and others. Prices of commodities. For example, someone in Chicago would be relaying prices of livestock or grain, and that information then would be spreading across the country via many various forms of transmitting. Morse code started out as spark gap. That sounds like this. And evolved into a continuous wave and more commonly heard sound like this. That was 9YI in the spark gap if you're unable to copy Morse code. And the CW was WOI. Now, if you were listening to the markets and you wanted to know what March corn 2010, what the price was, this is what that would sound like. Let me do some quick translation for you there. CH0, that stands for March corn 2010. The price, $3.79¾. RC, Cap Bentley, began the market news service back in 1943, began reporting market news on WOI. Dale Williams, my mentor, a man I worked for from May 75 to June of 77, got me involved in my interest in farm broadcasting, market news reporting, had a program called Farm Facts. In 1972, WOI Radio was celebrating its 50th anniversary. Don Forsling sat down for a lengthy conversation with R.C. Cap Bentley.
Well, if we were going to try to determine the most significant contribution that Iowa State College, Iowa State University, has made to the state of Iowa, I think number one on the list would have to be the development over the years of the WOI, or Iowa State University, Market News Service. And we have with us this morning a man who hasn't been heard regularly on WOI radio since 1965, but was heard very, very often and very regularly in the years between 1943 and 1965. R.C. Cap Bentley is back with us this morning, and we're delighted about that. And we're kind of going to spend a little time just chatting about the earlier years of Market News operation here and Cap's involvement in it. And I'd like to ask first, Cap, how did you get connected with Iowa State University at the very beginning? What brought you here? Where had you been before you came here?
Don, I finished my work up at North Dakota, and it was in the 20s, of course, and there weren't many opportunities open at that time, so I went to work in a Piggly Wiggly grocery store down in Minneapolis. That was the best I could do. But along that fall, after I'd gone up to Duluth to open up one store up there, my former professor, Cap Miller, up at North Dakota, said he had a fellowship down at Iowa State. Would I be interested in it? Well, I caught the next train and headed for Iowa State.
Then you've been here ever
since. I've been here ever
you?
Since.
You didn't work in the meat department at the Piggly Wiggly by any chance?
No, right? I was produce.
Well, your involvement with the radio market news began in 1943. What was the service like before that? What was it like when you found it?
Don, I had been in extension work and working with the grain trade, the livestock trade, the produce trade out over the state in extension outlook work during the year 1943. Because of the great need for grains, the warehouse division employed me to make a survey of warehousing and the condition of grain in warehouses across the country. And that gave me an opportunity to meet with a lot of the grain trade, not only in the Midwest here, but out in Oregon and back in some of the eastern centers. And I found that they were in great need of particularly the supply picture, so that the people out in the country would know what their competition was in various sections of the country, as well as locally within the state. So when I came back to Iowa State in the summer of 1943, I took my problem to the head of the department, Ted Schultz, over in economics, W.I. Griffith here at WOI, to see what was being offered here, to R.K. Bliss, director of extension that I was working with, and all three of them, as good directors do, say, well, if you think you've got something, go over there and see what you can do with it. So they gave me a 3 months leave over in economics to come over and outline a market program. I never did get back to economics.
What was the situation in terms of where the grower or the raiser of livestock found himself in those days? Was he in an informational advantage or disadvantage compared to the fellow who bought his products?
Well, this was the situation. You see, the central markets had the information the first thing in the morning. They had their wire services as among the major central markets. They knew what the supply was. Then they could call their people out in the rural districts and get a pretty good idea. If the supply was short over here, they could do very well by picking it up over in the other area.
Mm-hmm.
But out at the local elevator or the local buying station or the local produce or creamery, it was pretty difficult to get a hold of this until they got the paper maybe the next morning. Well, that's a little late to do business. Their demand was for more timely information as to what prospective supply was to come to market the next day, particularly in livestock and the produce trade. What was going to be available, what was their competition, and what could they expect in the market?
How did you publicize the availability of the service, and how long did it take to catch on? And how many people do you suppose actually made use of the service in those days, and still do, many of them?
Well, in the early stages of it, I'm quite sure that it was the elevator men that took advantage of it, rather than the local farmer and the buying station at the local point in terms of livestock. The farmer was too busy in the field or too busy doing that, and he hadn't gotten his wife attuned to taking the market. So it was still a matter of the local agency getting the information and using it. Now, if that was a cooperative, then the returns went back to the individual through his patronage dividends. If it's a private agency, his income would improve on that basis until it got widespread in terms of the local people knowing what the market was and what their produce was worth.
One of your jobs at Iowa State in running the market newsroom was to guide young men who come to the college and the university and take an interest in this type of activity. And a great many of them worked for you, and a great many of them have gone on to greater things, haven't they?
I was very, very fortunate in getting a very good quality group of students, both from journalism and from economics through the years, and they proved to be top-notch young people. Once they got over here and had a chance to apply what they had learned in their books and what they had experienced, those that came from the farm or close to the farm anyway, and began to see the dollars and cents value of this kind of information, many of them then looked for positions out in the area of marketing and distribution or in farm information, journalism. Yes, a number of the boys have gone into this. Ray Ryman went into farm journal work. And, of course, we have one of our men right here on campus over in economics, Gene Futrell,
right.
Was with me for a number of years. And there are many, many others scattered around the country that are doing wonderful work in this field.
One big change since that 1972 interview with Cap Bentley by Don Forsling, more than half of the students who have worked for me the past 19-plus years have been young women, journalism students, ag business students, economics students. That pretty much hasn't changed, but there has been a change in the gender. None of this would be possible, anything that we've broadcast on the radio at Iowa State University Extension, in market news and farm news, would not be possible without the students. I should also mention that Jane Schwartz was the market news secretary for a number of years with Dallas McGinnis and me. And before that, a number of other women took that position very seriously and made things happen, guiding the students, helping them report the market news information. Well, I tried to go back and find someone who would best remember some of the early days of market news information on WOI. now Iowa Public Radio. Dixon Harper, Dix, good friend of mine in farm broadcasting. He retired several years ago. He contacted me by Facebook. I was somewhat surprised to find Dix on Facebook. I'm almost as surprised that I am too. He contacted me, and we chatted a little bit via email, and I asked him if he would put together a recording of some of his remembrances of those early days working with CAP.
Doug, I appreciate the opportunity to be a part of this broadcast. Are you aware of WOI's long record of providing market news for Iowa farmers? It was late in 1921 or early 1922 that Andy Wolfers, the first voice ever heard on the Iowa State College radio station, copied the opening and closing Chicago hog prices sent by Morse code from the Great Lakes Naval Station and then rebroadcast them on 9YI, as WOI was called in those days. R.C. Cap Bentley, Extension Marketing Specialist, began broadcasting much more complete market reports on WOI in 1943. I started part-time on WOI in January of 1946. Cap had a senior student assistant named Roger Harrison at that time, who was about to graduate and went to WBZ in Boston as a farm broadcaster. I was an ag education major, and Cap found out that I'd had a couple of ag economics courses, and that's when he asked me to help him broadcast the market reports. From the opening hog flash through the mid-morning reports and the closing markets in the afternoon, Cap was responsible for 90 minutes of market news every day of the week. Cap had a full-time secretary, and they spent much of their time on the telephone or reading the ticker tape from the Chicago Board of Trade. They gathered reports from the 19 interior Iowa and southern Minnesota hog markets every morning. We also covered all of the terminal markets from Indianapolis to Denver and from the South St. Paul down to Oklahoma City. My own reporting schedule varied depending on my classes. Off the air, Cap was always working on charts, and the walls of his office were covered with trend lines. I wrote a feature story for the Iowa Agriculturist on Cap Bentley and his market news service on WOI, and later, the first article I ever sold as a journalist was a similar story for the Hog Breeder magazine. The experience of working with Cap Bentley and Dale Williams on the farm programs gave me a leg up over the other candidates for that first WMT Farm Radio Scholarship in 1947. During my senior year, my time was divided between working about 40 hours a week at WOI, doing interviews with extension specialists for WMT in Cedar Rapids, and, oh, by the way, going to classes. It's sad to see, but things change. Thanks for the time, Doug.
Let's go back now to the 1972 50th anniversary of WOI Radio and a market report from a voice that I know a lot of people remember.
And this is Dallas McGinnis with your market information today, and enjoying all the various visits the folks are having over across the campus in the studio today, celebrating the 50th anniversary. One thing I did think I'd do today, since we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of WOI, was to look back to April of 1922, 50 years ago, and see what the average prices of some of these commodities and grains were. Hog prices in Iowa in April of 1922 averaged $9.40 per hundredweight, $9.40 50 years ago. And the average price on cattle, $5.75 per hundredweight. Horses at that time were averaging $80 per head. And, of course, the soybeans, which are watched so closely today, were hardly being grown and certainly not being reported. Wheat prices were $1.19. Corn prices, 58 cents a bushel. Oats, 37 cents a bushel. So those are some of your prices 50 years ago, this month of April. And that's our information.
James is up next in Little Sioux. Hello, Jim.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
I was wondering, I had a question.
Rich Pope Monday.
Yes, it is.
I needed that confirmation.
I thought you did. That is Rich sitting in front of you.
It is.
In case you...
I recognize every whisker.
I'm just going to sit here quietly and watch you guys talk with each other.
You've never done that. What's going on?
This is Cindy Haynes with a Garden Calendar Minute.
This is an Invest Wisely Minute brought to you by Iowa State University Extension.
This is Chuck Schwab for Iowa State University Extension with the Safe Farm Minute.
I'm Weldon Gord, and I live in Des Moines.
You've been involved with this fiddler's contest at the Iowa State Fair for how long, Weldon?
50 years. I was about 25 and just learned how to play the violin like a fiddle, and I could not even get in the contest, but I started coming to the fiddler's contest, and I've enjoyed it ever since.
During Iowa State University's sesquicentennial year, many people who wanted a better grasp on the university's history went to the Special Collections Department at the University Library. Tanya Zanish-Belcher heads up the Special Collections Department, and there is a lot of information about the history of Iowa State University, going way back.
Well, right now, one of the things that we have on display in our department, the departmental reading room, is the 1858 Act, which created Iowa Agricultural College and Model Farm in 1858, founded by the Iowa Legislature, and it is on loan to us from the State Historical Society. Originally, we were known as IAC, and I should point out, although the alums don't like to see this, the text says that tuition will be forever free.
This is John Cresswell for Iowa State University Extension with a Nutrient Management Minute.
USDA released its final Hogs and Pigs Report of the Year 2007. We're going to talk about that report today with John Lawrence, Iowa State University Extension Livestock Economist, Director of the Iowa Beef Center. And John, basically, what did we learn in this last Hog and Pig Report, or latest Hog and Pig Report?
We learned that there's a lot of hogs out there. There's more than there were a year before, and quite possibly there's more than what USDA estimated.
This is Linda Nave with a Minute in Urban Agriculture.
Most corn producers, when they plant their seed, in fact, all of them, as I understand it, have some sort of seed treatment in their corn seed. We're going to talk seed treatment today with Pella Peterson, Iowa State University Extension soybean agronomist. And is soybean seed similarly treated?
No, it's not, Doc, but it's changing a lot. Previously, if you're looking back 10 to 20 years ago, soybean seeds were so cheap that, and we planted it so late that it was nothing to really worry about in Iowa.
Roger Elmore, Iowa State University Extension agronomist, and William Edwards, Extension economist. And boy, I have a lot of questions for you gentlemen here. And comments on risk management agencies' pilot biotech yield endorsement. You have RMA here and BYE. What are we talking about, Roger?
Well, the Risk Management Agency is a part of the USDA, but they've come up with a pilot biotech yield endorsement program.
Crop insurance has been around since the 1930s, and for many years it only covered yield losses.
Good. Welcome back to the microphone, Robert Wisner, Iowa State University professor emeritus right now, but he is keeping busy. I don't know if retirement was the right word for you or not, Bob, but welcome back.
Well, thank you, Doug.
Let's talk about what's going on here with crude oil.
Well, it's certainly been a big factor. As we're speaking, the second largest ethanol producing company in the country is in bankruptcy, and there are probably four or five more that are in bankruptcy. It's put quite a bit of stress on that industry, partly because of the collapse in the crude oil price, but not entirely. There's some other factors involved.
El Nino. Where are we with El Nino? We can't get through this show without talking about that.
It's such an important thing to us because we've been the past two winters with La Nina, the opposite of El Nino, and they've been rather harsh winters, and almost everyone's been looking forward to an El Nino winter. They tend to be on the mild side. And for the eastern corn belt, on the dry side. For the western corn belt, a little bit on the moist side as usual, but not enough to mess things up. the El Nino is still faltering. Right now, the Southern Oscillation Index is at minus 0.51. It's impossible to list everyone that has been involved in the production of market news and agricultural news at Iowa State University Extension and WOI Radio. As I mentioned, it all began with Cap Bentley. He was followed by Dallas McGinnis. I replaced Dallas. On the radio side, it was Dale Williams, my first boss in radio. I interned with him for a little over 2 years. And then, of course, Roger Brown replaced Dale Williams, and I came in to replace Dallas McGinnis and ended up replacing Roger Brown as well. So we combined the radio and the market news into one sometime around late 1990. Number one for me is thanking all of the students who have worked to get this market information on the air over the years. And that goes, I think I can say for Dallas and Cap, they both appreciate that as well. It just wouldn't be possible to compile all of this information on a daily basis without the help of dedicated college students at Iowa State University. That'll do it. Let's end with the theme that Dale used to always play at the conclusion of the program called Farm Facts.